John?
Yeah, hi.
Steve?
All right, sorry. I don't know exactly where that happened or how it happened.
Strangeness.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, great.
Okay.
Thanks, Laura. Cheers. Hi, Steve. Sorry
all
about
right,
that.
All right, so tell me more. So in 1977, huh?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we wanted to sort of just not very many, four or five people for whom that year was something quite special, really, and you know, for whom things happened that either kick-started their career or, you know, began something quite special musically. And obviously, one of the first people we thought of was you. And I know that particularly for you, that year was probably one full of kind of pain and pleasure as well.
Well, for me, at that time, that was the year just as I was finding out about Journey looking for a lead singer.
Yeah.
And I found out through a record executive, and he wanted to sign my band. I think I told you the story. My bass player died in a car wreck, so they played my demo tape for Journey's manager, unbeknownst to me, and then I got the phone call from Herbie Herbert, who was managing Journey at that time. And that was the first time I got together with them. I believe one of the very first times could have been at the Long Beach Arena because they were opening for Emerson, Lake and Palmer. So that was kind of the beginning of my career, which led into me joining the group. And in 78, I think, is when we recorded and did our first Infinity record.
Yeah. Well, I think you recorded it at the end of 77, according to the research I did, and then it came out at the very start. It came out just at the start of 78. Yeah, but just to backtrack slightly, I know that it was the 4th of July, wasn't it, when Richard died? And
yes, it was.
I know you've spoken about it before, but presumably at the time, it was obviously a horrible shock, but B, how did you feel personally? Because you withdrew, didn't you, for a couple of months, was it, from music and thought, you know, I might not do this for a while.
What I did at the time was I called my mom and I said, well, you know, Mom, this is the closest I've ever been to being signed to a record label because, as we know at the time, that was the sweetest thing that could ever happen to you as an artist.
Yeah.
At the record deal. And I said, every time I get closer to getting that record deal, it seems to be something just a little bit bigger says no. And that seemed to be what it felt like up to that point. And then here I was about to be signed to Chrysalis or Columbia. And Warner's was kind of snooping around. But the point is we had interest in the streets about the band I was in, the Alien Project at the time.
Yeah.
And so I called my mom and I said, you know, I think I'm going to pack it up and go back because our bass player, Richard Michaels, was just killed in a car wreck 4th of July weekend, Mom, and I don't think I'm supposed to do this. And she said, no, I'm really sorry to hear about Richard. That's terrible, but just don't leave. I said, Mama, I already gave my notice to the apartment, and I got 30 days. So next few weeks I'll be packing up and coming back down. And she kept on saying, no, don't give up. You know, something will happen. And I'm thinking, my mom, you know, she was the eternal optimist for me. And
believed
in me, you know, that something good would happen. And this time I had to just sort of like tell her, I don't think that's going to happen, Mom. So I'll be seeing you soon. All right. So fast forward a week or so, I get a phone call from Herbie Herbert, the manager, saying, I got your tape from Columbia Records, and Journey's looking for a singer. Are you interested? And that began the courtship of our relationship.
Yeah, because I believe you'd met Neil at some point in 76, hadn't you, for the first time?
Oh, yeah. I had my eye on Neil Schon for years because I knew,
right, yeah.
Oh, I knew this guy was the player, you know. He was the player
for
me. And I felt I was the singer for him. And through history, if you just look around, you know that in bands, there's always a lead guitar and a lead singer. There's never really a lead bass or lead drums or lead keyboard.
Yeah.
Unless you're Emerson, Lake and Palmer, maybe. But
but
for the most part, it's you know, Plant and Page. You know, it's always been that thing, you know. And so that being said, I knew that we were kind of salt and pepper and before we even met. And so I finally got to meet him through a friend of mine that I grew up with who was living in San Francisco by the name of Larry Luciano. And Larry Luciano was my childhood friend and was hanging around Santana and as a lot of bands of that era, and he knew Neil. That's when I first met Neil face-to-face. And so that began a little bit of a familiarity, so that when years later the odd situation showed up that his manager had heard my tape, he put two and two together and said, "Oh, you're Larry's cousin. I remember you."
Right.
You
know? Yeah. And then there's this sort of very famous story, and you can tell us now how much truth it holds, that Herbie kind of not snuck you on the road, but took you on the road with them for a little bit, for you to have a look at them. And but tell us, is that what happened?
It is a bit true. He
like all these things, yeah.
You know, I will just preface this next set of sentences with a little bit of a statement. You know, Herbie and I have had our falling outs from an artistic management standpoint. We had some of our disagreements for sure, which are normal to happen. But I must tell you that if it wasn't for Herbie Herbert, I am absolutely convinced that the band would not have wanted me in the band, because he believed in me and was telling him that this is the guy for you, and whether you like it or not, get used to it, because this is the guy that needs to be the singer in Journey. And I will tell you, he did that as he had already sort of made a bit of a verbal commitment to another singer, Robert Fleischman. And they were sort of, you know, romancing that idea and doing a few little gigs here and there, of which one I was privy to watch. And so I was kind of like the John Villanueva's cousin.
Right, yeah.
Who was one of the roadies of the time.
Right, that was what that was who you were supposed to be, your character.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And what did you make of them, kind of having this weird sort of, this weird view of them from the side of the stage almost? What were you thinking at the time?
Of the band Journey.
Yeah. What did you make of them up close like that? Because obviously you'd heard them, but
I guess it was different seeing
them up close.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they had more talent than they even needed.
Right.
Because they were in the virtuosity phase of their performance aspect, meaning they were really trying to participate in the Mahavishnu, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, forgive me, Emerson, Lake and Palmer virtuosity side of music, with lots of riffs and chops and very, you know, profound musical statements of that nature, which did not leave a lot of room for vocal
space. Yeah.
So that was what I saw, and I thought it was definitely not going to be easy to carve out some vocal locations for myself. But we did that. We worked on it hard together. And I think they were willing to open up slightly musically and not fill it up so much, to leave room for a voice. And like I said, there was more than enough of creativity from that band than they even needed.
And where do you think, I mean, aside from Herbie, where do you think that kind of desire to change was coming from?
Do you want the truth?
Yeah, of course.
Or would you like me to lie to you?
Well, let's start with the true version.
I guess we have been honest with each other. We might as well keep that going, eh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, the truth is, and I didn't find this out till years later, the truth is that the record label, are you there?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
The record label had made two albums, I think at least, the musical direction that they wanted to do, and we're not going to support the making of another one like that. And the record label wanted to make a conscious musical change in the band, a conscious musical change. And that meant they would like to see it become more song-oriented and add a singer, perhaps.
And yeah.
I think it started at the record label level and filtered to Herbie that, you know, the bottom line is Columbia Records has kind of given its all to the musical direction that they have believed in about as enough as they're going to.
Yeah.
And so the band at that point had to make a decision, either leave the label or make a musical change. And once again, I must tell you that Herbie Herbert, the manager, with a forceful, soft hammer, made it very clear that, you know, the band needs to grow and change and be more song-oriented. And not so much musical only oriented. And he began the making room for such.
Yeah, and what kind of a process was that? How easy was that? Because then you obviously had this intuition that you and Neil would work well together. When you started working together, what was that like? Did it fulfill your expectations? Was there a moment where you thought, I know this is going to work?
I think it was a struggle for everyone. I think it was a struggle for them to musically calm down enough to play Open Pockets to where where I could sing, you know, Lights in the City, you know. Where songs like Wheel in the Sky were possible, Feeling That Way. It was a totally different approach. I think they were doing the best they could to open up and deal with that being enough. And I certainly was doing my best being the new guy, in quotes, I might say.
Which is always difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, to be forceful and not lay down that we can't musically masturbate across these songs.
Right.
I mean, there'll be a time for that live where we're going to stretch out and make an incredible performance, which Neil Sean was the very best at, you know, as was Ainsley Dunbar and as was Steve Smith. I mean, and Greg Rowe, these guys could stretch out. They knew how to stretch out musically. They know that. But there's a time to do that, and then there's a time to make a record. And so I think they were having their challenges with playing simple, and I was having my challenges with trying to keep it simple.
And how much did you feel? I mean, you'd been through this experience. You'd lost your friend. You'd kind of, you know, your mum said this chance is going to come along. It came along. How much did you feel it was kind of fate, as it were? And how much did you feel it was a last chance? Were you kind of feeling excited or nervous, or what was your kind of mood at the time?
I was totally excited and totally nervous and apprehensive, and there was also a side of me that was a bit controlling over some of their musical ideas, I must admit.
Right,
because I felt like from a kid coming from Central San Joaquin Valley of California, a farm community, with a dream of getting in the music business, all of a sudden I'm in a band that's signed to a record label, and I'm actually going to be playing shows, which later our first tour was playing shows opening for other bands, and then all of a sudden we tried to headline 3,000-seaters with this brand-new band from L.A. called Van Halen opening for us. Listen, it was a magical time. I was extremely committed to not letting this slip away, so to speak. So I think there were times where I was a bit controlling, if I can tell on myself.
Right, yeah. I mean, how much do you think there was a general feeling in the air that music was changing and that there was a certain sound that was going to start to emerge? I mean, the Boston record had come out the year before, for example. And there was a
and
kind
you know,
of
I looked up on the net when I realized what you were talking about. Rumors was just released in September.
Yeah, Rumors came out that year. That's right. Yeah.
Right, and
yeah.
I will tell you that that record came out just I think a year before ours did, and set, I mean as far as earlier in the year I think, and it
yes.
set the precedence that selling 5 million copies, which was kind of unheard of until Boston and came along also.
Yeah.
But that set a new possible goalpost that nobody realized that people would buy that many records, really. And,
right.
You know, and
yeah.
so I remember listening to Rumors a lot, and I remember listening to Boston a lot. And I wasn't as much of a fan of Boston as I was maybe other groups, you know. But
right.
I certainly know that at the time I was 100% full belief that Journey had what it took, that Journey had the opportunity to stay focused on what we are and not let anybody derail us with any press or our reviews. So I didn't read any of them because I didn't want to
really?
Know. No, I did not. I did not want to know what anybody thought about the music because at the end of the night, if we got our encore, that's all I need to know. And if they like the songs when we're singing them, that's all I need to know. I don't care what
right, yeah, is. Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
care if some guy shows up for 20 minutes, you know, gets the set list sent to him by a road manager and then goes and writes a review about a show that he maybe not even seen. So I wasn't going to read those. I can
right,
tell you that
right.
I read 3 reviews in my life.
Right, come on.
Want me to tell you? I told you what they were. Did I tell
yeah,
you those?
Yeah, go on. Go on. Tell me what they were. Yeah.
One was when we had released a record, and kind of hesitate to even resurrect these statements because it pissed me off so much at the time.
right.
But one was the Rolling Stone, and we had released. I think it was one of our first live records. And some asshole said that Steve Perry on the captured record sings like a Nazi drill sergeant. And I thought, are you out of your
right.
fucking mind?
Yeah,
are you
yeah.
crazy? Are you nuts? So that pissed me off. And then some son of a bitch in Canada, I didn't read for years, and there's another one. maybe it's safe to go back in the water again. So I picked up one in Canada, and he was raving about Geddy Lee and talking about how I sing like Velveeta cheese and stick to your teeth. And I thought, well, that son of a bitch is my ass.
Yeah.
So I didn't listen to that anymore. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was one. Oh yeah, yeah. And then the Rolling Stone said something about that, you know, that, I don't know, Journey was, that was when they were trying to save the seals, and the Rolling Stone had covers of bludgeoned seals on the cover with a baby seal next to a bludgeoned mother, and it was like, that's what the Rolling Stone was doing at the time, right?
Really?
And all of a sudden, somewhere deep in the Rolling Stone, they made a statement that the band kind of sounded like a seal being bludgeoned to death with a club. And, you know, I got to tell you, that those are the 3 reviews I remember, and they're the most stupid, asinine statements that obviously somebody did not listen beyond their own resentments about something.
They couldn't get past
their own resentments at some level that didn't allow them to even hear past that. So honestly, I really continue to not really read reviews because if I believe the good ones, I guess I got to believe the bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good point. Yeah. I mean, you spoke a little bit about those, you know, those records that were big at the time. And I guess, you know, what you needed and what you came up with were 1 or 2 songs that sort of fitted with that remit, as it were. And, you know, Light certainly did that. You know, it was a song that put you on the stage.
Which songs do I think?
From the outside looking in, you say Lights, you say Wheel in the Sky, are songs that, given the context of the time,
yeah, that would be the beginning of 78.
You know, Yeah. I mean, you would say, given the context of the time, those were perfect songs.
Well, looking back, that seems to be the case. At the time, it was still a struggle for them to be heard.
Really? Okay.
Of course. We would tour, and we would work hard, and back in those days, people loved the music, and they would see you live, and then they would pick up the phone and call their favorite radio station and ask them to play it, because radio was the original internet, and where you'd hear your favorite music, and... you know, we'd go to record stores and sit there behind tables and sign albums, and people would show up, and you know, there was just different way that you did it back then. And so,
yeah.
I would say "Lights" became an iconic song for San Francisco first.
Yeah.
Then it sort of started to spread. I'll never forget the first time I heard "Wheel in the Sky" on a jukebox. I was with Neil Sean, and I really don't remember. Somewhere in USA, we had a night off, and so next to the hotel was this tiny pizza parlor. So I said, "Neil, let's go grab a slice or something." And I said, "Okay." So him and I went to the pizza parlor, and "Wheel in the Sky," I believe at that time, was our first single. I could be wrong, but I believe it was. So we were really playing a lot of shows and hoping that it would start to be played on the radio and stuff, and it was getting some airplay, but I'll never forget when I was in that pizza parlor and I walked over to the jukebox and decided I would play some music, and I looked and I saw "Wheel in the Sky" by Journey, and I put the quarter in and I played it, and I didn't say nothing. I sat down with Neil. I was just watching him, and all of a sudden the song started, and he looked at me and looked at the jukebox and started laughing, and we high-fived each other. It was a really magical moment that we had transitioned into a mainstream of exposure that we hoped that the music could break through to.
Yeah. And I guess the absolutely key point about "Lights" was that it was something you and Neil wrote together. Which kind of validated your idea that that you would, you know, you would be that sort of team.
I actually had the song sketched in my brain when I had been living in Los Angeles trying to get in the music business.
Really?
Yeah, and originally, to be perfectly honest, again, I was up at Griffith Park Observatory many nights just looking out over the amazing lights of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And being a country boy, it used to just astonish me how it would go on forever. And one morning, early in the morning, I was there, and the sun was coming up, and the lights were slowly starting to go down as the sun was occupying the sky. And the idea, when the lights go down, I'm sitting, the sun shines on L.A., was the original kind of...
Oh, really?
But it sat there in the back of my mind for about 2 years. And then I finally joined Journey and was at Studio Instrument Rentals in San Francisco on Folsom Street rehearsing the Infinity record and writing it. And I told Neil about this idea, and I played the drum pocket because it's a sort of a 16 feel. And so he liked it, and he wrote the bridge with me. And so the rest of it was written, and he wrote the bridge, and then, of course, he solos. And that's how that sunk. So then it quickly switched to going over the Golden Gate Bridge and observing the same time in the morning and watching the sun come up over San Francisco and the lights go down in the city and the sun shines in the bay. So that's what it looked like once I had moved up there. It seemed more fitting and more proper to that.
Yeah. And you talk about the final part of the year, I guess the last quarter of the year, was when you were writing and recording the record. What are your memories of it now? If someone says to you, mentions Infinity, what sort of pops into your head?
Roy Thomas Baker.
Right, yeah.
Let's just start there.
Yeah.
I've spoken to him.
Sorry?
Have you ever spoken to Roy Thomas Baker?
No, I haven't. No.
You should.
Right. Yeah, well, a lot of people do say that, yeah.
It's he's a very interesting character.
Yeah.
A brilliant English engineer, which, by the way, we always, all of us shared this one thing in common, was we loved the English sonics that seemed to keep filtering
right.
from the UK to America. It was always, for multiple different reasons, we thought superior to some of our American sonics that the records were showing up with. And
right.
we always wanted to know why, you know. Everything from you're on a different current, different cycles per second. To the equipment, to the vinyl that the UK was using was like the Beatles used virgin vinyl. The American vinyl was a blend of recycled. So what
okay.
would happen is your record wouldn't be as quiet. It'd have a little more grit to it. And then
yeah.
you drop a needle on an Apple record, and it would be just quiet as a mouse. And so there was all these different things that we always paid attention to. So that when Roy Baker was suggested by Columbia Records, because he had just done the Queen success
yeah.
and trilogies, we decided, well, wow, that would be pretty cool, you know. And I'm a new
yeah.
guy in the
yeah.
band, so I remember us all meeting Roy Baker and moving into a studio in San Francisco just south of Market called His Master's Wheels. And
yeah.
It had a beautiful old Neve console in it and a very large tracking room. And I remember Roy Baker setting up his mics way in the ceiling, and we're all just kind of beaming on what he's doing and watching him and learning a lot. Then we had a machine he brought along, which was a 40-track Stevens machine, which he had made by this gentleman in Burbank, California, who had found a way to make 40 tracks on a 2-inch head stack. And
right.
he did that, and so there started me stacking 8 voices across the bottom channels and then bouncing them to one channel, then wiping those 8 voices and doing the 8 voices of the third harmony, and then putting them up on another channel and wiping those, and then 8 voices of the fifth. And from that, you get, you know, at least 3 times 8 or 4 times 8 Steve Perry's on Light Them a City.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
stuff I remember learning from Roy and working on that.
And where was he? I mean, was this is obviously something he'd kind of worked on through his, you know, his career, but how... Because obviously you had Greg there who sang a bit as well, didn't you? Neil,
yes,
who would
Greg,
sing
yes,
backup vocals.
Greg was in the band, and so we at that
yeah.
point we shared vocals on songs like "Feeling That Way" and
yeah,
"Anytime."
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And how were you guys working? Because obviously, like Roy coming in throws another something into this new equation, doesn't he? You know, you're all kind of trying to find your way with each other, and all of a sudden there's another guy here who's got this great way of working, but it's something different. Again, how did that all kind of mesh together?
It seemed to be okay. We kind of just went with him, you know. And,
right, yeah.
And just sort of followed the lead because he was musical about it. And then he suggested some things like Neil to do violin guitars. So there's a lot of violin guitars, meaning single notes, multi-tracked across the 8 bottom tracks, and then bounced up to one track and then wiped. And then Neil doing
right,
the fifth.
Right,
And the third is the same thing. So you'll hear a lot of that on the Infinity record especially. And then later on as years went by, we brought some of that back. In other words, Neil did an incredible version of that years later on a song called Little Girl, which is on
right.
the Greatest Hits 2, which just came out.
So
we did take certain aspects of what we learned even way back then and brought it forward. But I must tell you a quick story that I don't know if a lot of people know, but Roy Baker was a bit of a rocker, I guess you would say, as far as liking to live in the shadows of Keith Moon, you know. So one night he had some sort of a fetish for fire extinguishers. And and I guess in England they're all CO2, I guess it is. They're cold
Yeah, cold foam stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, they're actually sort of foamy, cold, dry ice stuff.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it comes out with a big hiss. That's right. Yeah,
yeah. Right, and it's cold,
yeah.
and it's noise and all that.
Yeah.
So I
yeah.
guess that he told us there was wonderful stories with him and Freddie Mercury and making some of the Clean records that he would chase each other around with these fire extinguishers.
Yeah.
So that was all cute and fine. So one night we're working in San Francisco on the Infinity record at that studio, His Master's Wheels. And we all took a break and went and had sushi, and some people got a little too deep in the sake. And when we got back, we were a bit shit-faced. And we proceeded to try to get started to work when Scotty, one of our road techs at the time, decided he would, you know, mess with Roy Baker by grabbing a fire extinguisher and just, you know, pretending like he was going to shoot it at him, okay?
Yeah.
And Roy Baker thought that was cute, but nothing really happened. Well, Roy Baker grabbed one and chased Scotty because he needed no more than that to go all the way with
it. Yeah.
So he chased him through the hallway, into the tracking room, around the tracking room, into the control room, and back out to the sidewalk. What Roy didn't know is in that particular case, it's a dry chemical extinguisher,
right.
which fills
yeah.
the room with the most fine particle dust that you couldn't breathe. It kills the oxygen in the room and some ammonium stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So we walk in. We can't go back in, first of all, because the room is just completely unbelievably full of this chemical. Finally, when it settles, we go back in, and the place looks like it's snowed everywhere. And the console, sadly to say, is covered with dust. And when you move the fader, it's gritting. And we look at the tape machine. And at the time we were working on Open the Door, I think it was called at the time. And so we quickly took that tape off. And I think we saved some of the degrading aspects of that tape being damaged. Needless to say, the owner of the studio and punched Roy Baker in the face.
Really?
and we had to leave that studio and come to Los Angeles to a place called Cherokee
Whoa.
To finish vocals because an entire lawsuit entailed against Columbia Records and that studio owner.
God. So when it says on the sleeve, recorded at, you know, His Master's Wheels and Cherokee, there's a
That's
reason
what
for
it
that.
Means. I should say recorded at Master's Wheels, finished at Cherokee.
I mean, asking a couple of more sort of general questions about the year itself. Obviously, it was the year Elvis died, for example, to set it in context. What do you remember about those kind of wider events of the year?
You know, I was only an Elvis fan insofar as it was really before my time, but I remember as a small child loving Hound Dog and loving Jailhouse Rock. I believe he recorded that too, and that was it. I didn't really like as much of all the rest of it as everyone else did. I kind of moved into the R&B aspect of music.
Yeah. But do you remember the whole kind of outpouring, though, the news stories and the where you were when you heard that kind of
sense
of
it being
a huge event?
Yeah, I was in Los Angeles trying to get in the music business, and I was at a friend's house, and I heard that Elvis had died, and it was just kind of overwhelming. That was possible because I was so young.
Wow!
It was like, how could that be possible? Because he was really one of the bigger, more bigger than life, iconic people in the world, and it just seemed like that just can't be possible. And yet it was. And then you know, we did research, and everybody started finding out that he was a bit addicted to painkillers and.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true, but they say he died on the toilet. I don't know.
Yeah.
heart attack. It wasn't exactly the most glamorous thing to way to go.
It's not the way we want to go,
But it was a bit rock and roll, I might say.
I guess so, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And
a
what
bit
do you think you, when you see...
Version.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, also it was, you know, it was the, I suppose, the year the Sex Pistols came to America as well. Was there any kind of consciousness of that?
Well, yeah, of course, and also I remember the Clash released, I think, London Calling or somewhere around that same era.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere, you know, and I was just sort of devastated by the Clash and the Sex Pistols because it was so powerful, and it was so raw, and it was had so much fuck you in it that I just really loved it and was sort of watching it at a distance, you know, and seeing how it was going to navigate itself in the U.S. culture, because it was just so rock and roll, to be honest with you. It was like the next incarnation of
the fuck you of
rock and roll, you know. And then, of course, I don't think I've ever heard a better name for a band than the Sex Pistols, probably a little bit second only to the Rolling Stones, but the Sex Pistols is an amazing name for a band. So that caught my attention right away.
Yeah, yeah,
So
No, sorry, it was just, I mean, because they were kind of, at, you know, obviously over here, it's a much smaller country and it's much easier to make an impact, but they were sort of so anti-everything that American band stood for, that radio play stood for. That did you kind of feel that they were almost standing against something you were trying to achieve, or did that not bother
you? Oh, no,
you?
I didn't feel threatened by them at all. I just thought it was another evolution of the edge of rock and roll, and I didn't feel any competitive threat whatsoever. You know, I mean, it happened again in the 90s when you know, Nirvana and all these Seattle groups decided to turn another corner with their recklessness, and everybody at that point had worked so hard to be so slick and proficient and get better at their craft, because you've got to remember that we were all recording directly to tape. There was no grid. There was no quantizing. There was no auto-correct to tunings.
Yeah.
It was tape. There was an old saying back in the day, tape don't lie. So,
right.
You know, whenever you throw hamburgers out there, the tape's going to play hamburgers. So, that was the deal. And so everybody kind of was going through such a learning curve, a painful learning curve of how good they were or how good they weren't by what was coming back on tape. And so you'd sit there and listen to yourself and you'd think, well, that's fantastic. Well, I certainly ain't liking that, though. You know, so it was going to the, as we used to say, to the woodshed, you know, to shed your chops and get better at what you do. So everybody had consistently gotten better and better and better. And then all of a sudden, none of us really believed it was possible that a group could just be a garage band like Nirvana and tear it all down.
Yeah, yeah,
and
they did.
And it was almost as if that's what had to happen to tear it all down, to start over.
Yeah. When you kind of look back at pictures of the band and yourself back in 77 and that, does that make you nostalgic? What do you think of, like, the way you looked and the, you know, kind of fashions
of
the day?
You know, it's so funny. The androgynous thing, I think, is just is pretty amazing how it felt so natural and so right and so anti-establishment to be...
Dressing in mass
androgyny, you know? I mean, and it was the Stones, it was us, it was, you know, the New York Dolls, it was Queen, it was everybody, you know? And so, it just, to me, I just loved it. I still look back at it with awe that I would do that in a second exactly the way I did it all over again if I could.
Really?
Oh my God! Yes, I have no, I have no problem. I still struggle with my hair's too short. Maybe hair's too long. Nowadays, I'm about to get a cut tomorrow because it's about, you know,
really?
3 inches below my shoulder and it's getting a little long. But back then, sweetheart, she was hot.
Yeah.
She was skinny. She was hot.
Yeah. Very good. Listen, Steve, that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely perfect.
So we need to get together and do this more often, I think.
I'd really love to.
You always have such fantastic questions. And, I'll tell you one more thing I just want to add, if I can.
Yeah, go on. Yeah, of course, yeah.
You know, the Clash and the Sex Pistols and groups like that, I think they really taught the whole American version of it, like the straight edge movement and things like that, what it was about. And then I won't mention any names, but some, because I don't want to, you know, come off like a shithead, but I must say some of the groups that are considered punk today are really not punk at all.
No, yeah.
And, you know, it's amazing how even in the UK they're embraced as such, but the truth is, no.
Yeah,
the Sex Pistols,
yeah, that's right.
Clash, I mean, you know, there's some amazing groups that really shook it up. I could just still hear that guitar on London Calling. London Calling. It's just driving. It's driving with English sonics and a lot of fuck you. I just love it.
Yeah. Hey, listen, also, I can't let you go without asking. Last time we spoke, you said you were kind of halfway to getting your home studio built.
How's
it going?
It's probably about 10% away from finished, and the only thing I need to do now is buy the tower, and then load the tower up. I have a laptop in there now, but load the tower up and buy some more mics. I'd say it's really there, but right now I've actually been living in another area for some other reason, which I can't get into right now, a family reason. And so it's taken me away from my studio a bit, but I hope to return really soon and, you know, start to do some recording. You know, it's I don't think people understand how difficult it is to make musical contributions after you've made one.
Right.
You know,
that's interesting.
You work your whole life to be part of an industry and to reach out and have people hear what you hope be a body of work of music. And if you're fortunate enough to have that happen, then it's almost a benchmark that you can never live up to again. And so to record music again, I'm going to have to drop that reality and just continue.
That feeling, make music.
And feel what I feel. And know there will be many people who will make comparisons and some won't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't, I don't know. I would say that all of your fans and followers would say you can't let that stand in the way, you know. They just want to hear you sing.
I hope that's the case. I really do, because that's all I really want to do, and that would be great.
Yeah, well, listen, it's like, I still think out of all, you know, all of the records of yours I had, For the Love of Strange Medicine is probably almost my favorite.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Thank you so much.
Someday we should talk about all the problems that went down making that record. Anytime you want to, just get a hold of Laura. She'll find me, because that record was an interesting labor of love, and I almost followed suit with George Michael's.
He was trying
to get off the label, and he's going to get off. The label's killing my records because they don't want me to do solo, so I almost followed suit with that. But
really, yeah.
I watched them destroy him in America, and it was just the most pitiful thing I ever saw in my life. So I just decided to disappear and not fight City Hall, so to speak.
Yeah. But, I mean, you left it's just such a fantastic-sounding record, that is.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much. Yeah. Wow, thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people do really, you know, really big fans of that, which is... But, yeah, if we can do the story of that one day, that would be great.
Anytime you want, we'll do it.
Yeah. Oh, well, look, I really appreciate your time again, Steve. It's been terrific talking to you.
All right. You take care, mate, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
And you. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.